Energy, energy.
Come on in.
Get real close, because you're listening to Snap Judgment, the podcast. Storytelling with the beat. Get ready.
All right.
Step away from the dial. Put your hands on your headphones. You're busted.
Welcome to Snap Judgment from NPR and PRX. My name is Glenn Washington. I don't know about you, but I've had the cuffs put on me several times. Clack, clack, they put your hands behind your back, watch your head. And no, I've never committed a crime. But that never stopped them. And some of y'all out there know what I'm talking about. Some of you had no idea. You don't know what it's like to be busted. And as a public service for you today on Snap Judgment, Storytelling with a Beat, we're going to take you there. See, whether you did it or not, getting caught ain't a whole lot of fun. Now, one of my favorite storytellers in all the land came in to tell us why she dissed us and did not show up to tape a story. Said she got busted. What? Keep that tape rolling, baby. Yeah, I hit record while she told her story about why she didn't come in to tell her story. Because that's how we do. Understand, she didn't prepare this. She was kicking it. But when you are an amazing storyteller by the name of Miss Joyce Lee, sometimes that's the best way to lay down a track. Two-time National Poetry Slam champion, one of my favorite artists in all the land. Listen close and understand. This piece does mention some illicit activity. Miss Joyce Lee does not condone drug use, and neither does the Snap. Thank you.
All right, this story starts when I was just looking for romance, okay? So I went to the bar to go get me something to drink, and I saw these eyes staring at me, and this guy was fine, but he was surrounded by women, and later on in the night, he came and sat next to me, and he followed me all night. We talked, and I loved how persistent he was, not to mention he was fine. So by the end of the night, I gave him my phone number, and we started talking. Let's call him Damien. Me and Damien started seeing each other full time. I just loved him, and he loved me, and I was like, wow, he's everything I've been looking for. This joker was so romantic. I'm talking about everyday flowers. So the relationship was perfect. Until one night, I had a show at the Mitchell Brothers Theater. So, of course, I was like, I'm going to get up here and look really scantily. So he comes, and then I was like, you know, tomorrow I have to go and meet Rebecca for the Snap Judgment thing. So I need to be there at 8. Not getting dressed, I need to be there. So right after I perform here, I need to leave and go home and go to sleep. He was like, okay. So then we left from there, and he was like, I just want to go by this club, and I got to go pick up something. And I was like, all right. So we stayed there until 2 a.m. at the club, and I was like, for real, I have to be somewhere at 8. So I'm sitting there impatient, kind of fuming, not really saying much, but just kind of giving him this, you know, we got to go look. This joker did a line of cocaine in front of me. You hear me? Did a line of cocaine in front of me, and my world came crashing down. I was like, I'm ready to go. I have to leave right now. And so we get in the car, and I was like, I don't even know if you should be driving because you're high on coke. And he was like, why do you keep talking like this? And I was like, this is a deal breaker for me. Like, this is actually me breaking up with you during this conversation. So we are having a serious debate. No screaming, no nothing, just serious. And the cops blurp the car. So he pulls the car over. Keep in mind, I'm dressed like a whore, okay? The cop comes out with gun drawn. We are in Oakland now. We are not in San Francisco anymore. And I was like, wait a minute. Why are your guns out? And he was like, because his hands are not on the steering wheel. And I was like, Damien, put your hands on the steering wheel. So then he did that, and the cop put away his gun. Next thing you know, there's three cop cars behind us. There's about six or seven cops, all of them white except one. Damien is in handcuffs at this point and in the back of the cop car. Remember, I'm still dressed like a whore with my hands up. The black cop is on the side of me, and he tells me to roll down my window, and I do. And he's not moving his lips, but he's saying, get out of the car and stand next to me. And I'm wondering, should I trust him? F*** it. Who else can I trust in this situation? So then I get out of the car, and I'm like, am I in trouble? And he's like, I don't know. So they go in the back seat of Damien's car, and under the seat, they pull out all of his like muscle protein shakes that I have personally seen him like scoop up and put in his drink and shake up and drink. And they put like maybe 16 bottles on the hood of their car. And I'm thinking, they're empty bottles. This motherfucker had 8 ounces of weed, hella cocaine, pills, with every time they open up another muscle thing, I was hyperventilating. I was like, oh my God. I was like, I need to sit down, because all I kept thinking about was, how am I supposed to call Rebecca from jail and cancel the snap judgment? The cops are still flashing a flashlight, but the flashlight goes off the canisters and onto me. The black cop grabbed me by my shoulders and he was like, I'm assuming you do not know this gentleman. And I said, apparently I don't. And he was like, did you know that was in the car? And I said, I had absolutely no idea. And he was like, you need to hurry up and sign this. I've already written out this story. I swear to God, I don't even know what I signed. I could have sold my mama's soul. I'm telling you. And I was like, can I talk to this I don't know really quickly, please? The officer was like, yes. So he handcuffed in the back of the car, and they got to roll the window down for his pathetic ass. And he's looking at me like, you know, baby, I was really hearing what you were saying, and I'm really going to change. And I was like, this is not the time. It's over. And he was like, all right, well, I need you to call my mother. I said, I've never met your mom. He was like, I need you to call my cousin. I was like, I don't know her either. And he was like, I need you to call my wife. And I start grinning. And I said, give me your wife's number. I'ma talk to her about letting your ass loose. And he went to jail. And the sweet cop cut up the heater and drove me home. And I got off scot-free. And that is me looking for love.
I'm Patrick Martin. I'm an illusionist, a conjurer for all my life. This deals with a time that I was working in Europe back in 1988. I was invited to a theater festival in West Berlin. I wanted to visit the East, so I asked my hosts, can you take me across the border to see what's happening on the other side of the wall? And they said, no. I said, what? He said, well, we are West German. It would take us a week, maybe 2 weeks, to get a pass, a visa, to go across. You are American. Go tomorrow morning to Checkpoint Charlie. They give you a visa. You can go right across.
Berlin was divided in half, and Checkpoint Charlie was the only place where you could go across to visit East Berlin. And then they grabbed my hand and said, but be back before midnight. And I kind of laughed, thinking, well, what happens after midnight? Do I turn into a pumpkin? They did not laugh. They just clutched my hand a little tighter and said, be back before midnight. In the morning, I got a visa. They gave me the name of a friend of theirs that lived in East Berlin named Anno Hohn. And Anno Hohn was my guide. He took me around. At first, when you're going into East Berlin, everything is nice and bright and new buildings. And I thought, wow, it looks very similar to the West. But when I went to visit Anno, he was a little deeper into the city. And I noticed that as you got deeper into East Berlin, it became more gray. The buildings were older. Some of them were abandoned.
Many of them still had bullet holes from World War II, so it was not the same maintenance, I guess, as West Berlin. Otto took me into several places. We went to some restaurants and some parks. And finally, he took me to several bars. And we went to the oldest bar in Berlin. As we walked in, everything was quiet. And no one was talking. And we went into the corner and said, what's the matter? He says, it is you. You are dressed different. They know you're not from here. They are suspicious. I said, well, should I do some magic for them? So he said, I will ask the bartender. So he went to the bartender, and I just followed behind him. And I noticed there was a shot glass on the bar, so I just picked it up, toasted somebody that was across the bar, and instead of drinking it, I poured it into my hand. I then squeezed and then dropped out of my hand a bunch of German coins. And they scattered all over the bar, and it got everybody's attention. I then ordered a drink for everybody. Everybody had a drink, and then I started doing some magic. And pretty soon, everyone was surrounding us, and we were everyone's friends. We were just having a marvelous time. I noticed on my watch that it was 1:30 in the morning. I said, Anno, what happens after midnight if I'm not on the other side of the border? And he looked at me very seriously. He said, you are in trouble. He rushed me back to Checkpoint Charlie, stopped in front of it, said, I cannot go any further. So I walked into Checkpoint Charlie, and I was immediately surrounded by dogs and by guards. And somebody took my passport and pointed to the visa page and started saying something in German. And I told them I don't speak German. I was brought over into a room, given an interrogation form, and filled everything out. And then a soldier walked in. He goes, Mr. Martin. I said, you speak English. He said, a little. Come with me. We walked down the hall to a counter, and he tapped the counter with his hand. He said, empty your pockets. And I thought, wait a minute, empty my pockets? I have to leave. And I remember seeing a movie where after you empty your pockets, then they put you in jail. So I said, I have to actually be leaving now. And he, empty your pockets. So I very gingerly took out some keys and some coins and a deck of cards. Immediately, as soon as he saw the deck of cards, he picked it up, held it up to the other soldiers and said, so you are a gambler. And I said, gambler? No, I'm a magician. He goes, what is magish? I said, I'll show you. So I showed him my most visual, a dazzling little card effect, thinking this is really going to impress him. No change of expression. And he called over the other guards. And I thought, great, of all the people in Germany, this guy hates magic. I get surrounded by the other guards. He leans over to me and with the same serious expression says, show them. So they started laughing and they seemed to be enjoying the magic. And I thought, finally, they're loosening up. And then suddenly they snapped to attention and the commandant started walking down the hall. And he was wondering why his soldiers were surrounding this foreigner. And instinctively, I spread the cards and said, pick a card. He spoke a little English, so he pulled one out. I asked him to put it back in after looking at it and mix it up, and then to find his card. He looked down and was looking through the deck, and I had secretly stolen his card out of the deck. I licked the back of it, stuck it to my forehead, and waited. He did not see this, but all the other soldiers did. They had to stifle their laughter because this was the commandant. The commandant finally went through all the cards and said, my card is not here. And then looked up, saw the card on my forehead, did not laugh. He did not seem pleased. And I had a vision of now a firing squad taking me out. And then his mouth gave a little curl. And then he's kind of snarled and then went back and went, ha, 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 ha. And then all the other soldiers went, oh, ha, ha, ha. And then the guy that pulled me over originally said, Mr. Martin, take these things, put them back in your pocket and leave. I said, do you think I should show them one more trick? He shook his head, said, you should leave now. I took all the things, took the last little train back to West Berlin, and that's how I escaped from behind the Iron Curtain.
Patrick Martin is a professional illusionist who wows all of his audiences. From Walter Cronkite to the First Lady, you can find out more about him on our website, snapjudgment.org, Facebook, Twitter, all kinds of ways to hit that snap. And some of Patrick Martin's tricks, when you see them, I swear, you'll know too, they are of the devil. That piece was produced by our own Stephanie Fu, and she has never been busted, but you come on back here in a minute and get busted with the snap. Today, we're getting busted. And this story was brought to us by one Matt Larson, who's an independent producer finishing up his PhD in biophysics. Smarty smart. Probably one of the only guys in the world who could bring this story. He takes us into a land, into an experience I didn't know anything about. Snap judgment.
The experiment was beautiful.
Imagine sitting in an auditorium and there's a big movie screen and you see one cell is the star of the movie. You could see the wave of fluorescence move across the cell. When it hit the nucleus, it split into two pieces and moved around the nucleus and then met up on the other side. And then once it met up, it exploded. It looked exactly like a fireworks display in a T-cell. The audience oohed and aahed.
That's Lawrence. We used to be classmates in a biology PhD program at Stanford. When he talks about the audience being wowed, he's not exaggerating. I was there. People were blown away. What was so exciting about these results, besides a cellular fireworks display?
It indicated that there could be these patterns in a cell that are telling you something about the signal they're receiving from foreign pathogens.
Most of the time, you're looking at a static table of numbers or a lifeless graph. But this was an actual video of a cell responding in real time with fireworks.
So scientists love things like that.
And he wanted in.
I remember leaving thinking I got to talk to him right away so I can try to get to be, you know, a part of that, get to work on it.
But, as is often the case in research, things didn't work quite as well as he planned.
3 months of working, trying to set up the experiments in our lab and thinking we were just not doing it right. And it was very frustrating. I remember sitting in the microscopy room, a dark room, you know, like a closet, trying to make these movies and just not getting enough signal.
Fortunately for Lawrence, someone had already done this experiment in another lab across the country. These were the pioneers of the technique. In fact, the only ones who were able to get this thing to work at all. And he decided to call them to get some advice.
They sort of gave us these vague lines of, it took them 3 years or something to be able to set up this instrument, and so you shouldn't expect to be able to just do it in a couple of months. So then we made the decision that I should go to their lab and see what was going on.
In a research lab, there's the head guy, the principal investigator. He's the professor. He gets the grants, and he gets all the credit. He's the guy who gets the Nobel Prize. Then there's the postdoctoral researcher, or postdoc. This is the guy who does the day-to-day, who grows cells, runs experiments, and writes up the results. And the postdoc in this lab was a little strange.
He made a lot of jokes, and he made it seem like I wasn't going to be able to learn how to do what he could do.
Then there was this little matter of the microscope.
And this is where things started to seem strange, because their microscope was basically a piece of crap. I certainly didn't say, you know, your microscope's crap, we shouldn't be able to do this. I just kind of went along with it.
The postdoc guides Lawrence through the experiment.
The raw data looks strange. He said he thought that he saw something while we were taking the movies, so he kind of hinted that there might be something in there to find. I hadn't seen anything. It just looked like noise. It looked like you turn your television on and it's not tuned properly. You get just snow. So I started looking through them. one by one. He had given me about 100 images, so it took me a long time to go through them. And then I came across one where, you know, halfway through the movie, this ball of, you know, bright signal went in a circle, like it could have been a cell outline, like sort of an oval across the screen.
These were the movies that Lawrence had been trying to get for months, but they didn't look quite right. Anyone could miss it. In fact, everyone missed it. There was something off.
There were pixels in the region of the image where the bright signal was that were all the exact same value.
And pixel values like these are completely unnatural. They should be much more random.
You know, that's really, really weird. To be honest, at this point, I was wondering if, you know, some data was being faked.
Most image acquisition software doesn't allow you to draw on movies.
Because most people don't want to do that.
So the postdoc had to export the file, draw on it with Photoshop, and then restate the image as raw data.
And then that's why there are those strange pixel values there. So that made sense. It was very exciting to see that. I mean, I really was sort of thinking, like, you know, I'm really onto something. He might really be faking all of this. And I just thought I needed to find better evidence. And I mean, I wanted a slam dunk case. So the idea I came up with is that I would ask to prepare the sample, and I would leave out the dye that illuminates the signaling. And without that dye, there's absolutely no way you should be able to do the experiment. But if he was drawing on blank images, he wouldn't know the difference. And he'd probably fake the data again. Then I'd know for sure. Well, I went in and asked to prepare the sample, and he said, yeah, sure, that's fine. He even let me do the whole experiment myself. So I pricked myself and, you know, got blood out and centrifuged the cells out and added nothing to the cells, basically. I took the dye out and pipetted it into the trash. I took the sample and put it on the microscope the same way and took a whole bunch of images. I took, you know, 100 images again. And I got lazy during the middle of it, and so I had the illumination off for some of the images. I mean, I was just taking white noise. He came back, and I gave him the images. I made a point to go outside and, you know, check my email or something. And it took about 20 minutes. I took the data back again to the coffee shop, and I was going through them, and sure enough, there were waves just like the ones I saw the previous day.
So what were you thinking at this point?
I got him.
Lawrence goes to the boss of the lab, the principal investigator, to tell him what he caught the postdoc doing.
You know, I don't think he had anything to do with the, you know, the actual fraud. And so I think he was genuinely shocked. And I don't think he actually thought it was true. And so, you know, his suggestion is that we all three, myself, him, and the postdoc, all go into the microscopy room and set it up together that day and make it work.
Picture it. Lawrence is in this tiny little room with two of his superiors, one of whom he's accused of fraud. And the postdoc knows it.
That's the first time he knows that anybody ever expected him of this fraud that he had been doing for years. So we were taking images and trying to see this flash move across the screen. And I noticed while we were taking the images, the postdoc had his hand on the focus knob of the microscope while the movie was being taken. And every once in a while, he would, you know, flick the focus knob real fast, back and forth. You know, he would never do that when you're taking a movie or something. You want it to be in focus and stay in focus. But he was trying to get any little flash to go across the screen that might make us think that there's signal in that movie. You know, he was very desperate. That was a very, very uncomfortable day. You know, I was just happy to be going back to the hotel. And so I just went back to my room and I was, you know, relaxing. I think I was watching the news and it was late. There was a knock on my door and it was like, I didn't go to the door because I couldn't imagine who was knocking on my door like that. And I thought that it might be the postdoc. And so what I was thinking is, you know, did he follow me here? Because that's the only way he could find my room, because those hotels won't give it out. So he must have followed as the PI drove me home and watched what room I went into and then waited, you know, waited. It was like 4 hours later. So I don't know, he was like stewing over this for 4 hours, and he comes up to my room and knocks on my door. But I wasn't sure it was him until he said, "Lawrence, I know you're in there." It was clearly him outside my door. And then my phone rang in my hotel room. I picked it up and said hello, and there was just breathing on the other end. I waited a few minutes, and then I just sort of peeked out the window to see if anybody was there, and nobody was there anymore. I wasn't looking forward to that night of sleep, you know, and I decided to change hotels. So I packed up my stuff, and I was kind of scared for the walk down to the hotel lobby. You know, it's a long way from faking data to murder, or, you know.
Right.
But you know, it's still weird to follow somebody to their room, and, you know, I didn't know what he wanted.
Lawrence changed hotels without incident. There were no more knocks on the door, no more late-night calls. And Lawrence went back home to California the very next day. Lawrence's lab immediately dropped the project. There was a brief investigation at the collaborator's university, and the postdoc was asked to leave. And that's it. Nothing really came of it. The only solid proof that anything actually happened came 5 years later, when a retraction notice appeared in a scientific journal where two of the studies were originally published. The notice simply read, "On the basis of the unavailability of the original source data, we hereby wish to retract these works. We deeply apologize for any difficulties caused by this incident." There's no mention of scientific fraud, no mention of fake data, and certainly no mention of Lawrence.
Many thanks to Matt Larson for bringing us that piece. And understand, you do not have to be an astrophysical botanist, pioneer, whatever it is. You know, just be yourself. Snapjudgment.org. Leave us your stories. I know that you've done something illicit, something crazy, criminal you don't want to share with close friends. Share it with strangers at snapjudgment.org. Facebook, Twitter, go on ahead and get you some. Snap Judgment will be right back in a moment. Welcome back to Snap Judgment from NPR and PRX. I'm Glenn Washington, and we've all made mistakes. We all have. But some mistakes hurt more, they cost more, and dig deeper than others. This next piece, brought to us by our own Rita Daniels, where she takes us to the land of enchantment, or as the locals call it, the land of entrapment. And understand, this is the Busted episode. There is some drug use, some violence in this piece, and of course, the names have been changed to protect the innocent and the guilty.
It's 1992, and Alicia is 15 years old. She lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
So captivating, the presence of those big mountains right at the base of Santa Fe, and so much for tourists to come and marvel at.
It's a Friday night. She's at the mall, and she runs into a couple older girls, Linda and Mary. And they're all hanging out at the arcade looking for boys, but they don't like the typical guys.
I didn't hang out with jocks. I didn't hang out with nerds. I didn't hang out with the spider people, who are like the people that would wear a lot of black makeup. I hung out with guys that drove mini trucks, little trucks, and they're dropped down, and they have like profile rims, and they have boom, 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 boom.
In fact, they don't even want to be at the arcade with these loser teenagers and their video games. They want to be at the Ice Cube concert in Albuquerque. They don't have tickets and they don't even have a car, but for every problem, there's a solution.
Mary's like, "We should just steal a car." It was very nonchalant. "Let's just steal a car."
After some more big talk, the three girls split up. Alicia goes off to smoke a joint and the other girls are hanging out in front of the arcade. At 9:15, the movie's let out. People stream towards their cars, and Mary and Linda spot this German woman in her 50s, an obvious tourist. On the spot, they concoct a simple plan.
Mary was telling her that we had to get home to do homework.
The woman's just gotten out from seeing this movie, Grand Canyon. It's a film about possibilities and the kindness of strangers. The girls are freezing, underdressed, and she takes pity on them.
All of a sudden, I hear a horn beep, and I look, and it's this shiny red car, and Linda and Mary were waving at me, smiling. They're in the car. There's this woman driving, and Mary's like, Christina, we found a ride. They were calling me Christina, and Christine was not my name. As my hand went on that car door to open up the car door, that was that critical point where I didn't have to go. Either you decide to bail and not go with your friends, or you just kind of go with the flow.
And what happened?
I just got in. And the lady smiled and she said hello. And I was like, oh, what have I got myself into? Are we really going to do this? Stealing a car from somebody. It's kind of a different animal.
Alicia's in the back seat, right behind the woman. Mary's in the front seat and is giving the woman directions. Directions to nowhere. They drive down a frontage road on the outskirts of Santa Fe.
Mary just directed her to just go to some random driveway.
No one's around. It's snowing, freezing cold, and silent.
Mary looked at me, and she pointed at the purse strap, like, to do something with my purse strap. Like, as if I was supposed to strangle her or choke her, I guess.
The girls are mouthing, do it!
They thought that I would have the cojones to do it. What? Doing that? Are you crazy? No. Hell no. And that's, I think, when she kind of figured out what was going on. And she started screaming. She was screaming, help. Help! And there was no one out there. No one could help.
The woman spots her chance, and she grabs the car keys and bolts out of the car. Linda and Mary chase her, and Alicia takes off in the opposite direction, and she starts running away from the whole scene.
Mary screamed out my name twice, my real name. Get the keys! The keys!
The woman's on the ground. Linda and Mary are kicking her.
It was pretty bad. It was really hard to watch that. I didn't like the fact that they were beating on her.
So Alicia turns back around.
I didn't want it to get worse than it already was. And if that meant telling her whatever it took to just get her to give the keys to us. So I was like, all right, we have a knife. We don't want to use it.
They were holding her down, and I wrestled them from her hands.
And off they go.
As we were speeding off, and we got in the car, I looked out the back window, and I didn't see the woman. I just turned my head, and I just faced the other direction. We left her. It's been done. Get out of here. Ugh.
Left alone on the side of the road in the middle of winter, the woman's then attacked and mauled by a dog. Disoriented, she makes her way to this unlocked tow truck, and she pounds the horn in desperation until someone finally comes to her rescue. She's taken to the hospital, and the police ask, who did this to you? The girls get to Albuquerque. They've missed the Ice Cube show. It's all been for nothing. Mary calls her drug dealer boyfriend, and he springs for some hotel room in a seedy part of town.
He destroyed the car, pretty much, and then abandoned it in some janky old apartment complex on Candelaria Boulevard. I dyed my hair.
By Sunday night, Alicia just wants it to be over.
I just wanted to be home. I wanted normalcy, like really bad. So I call my dad. I said, Dad, you gotta come pick me up. I'm in Albuquerque.
He comes.
I was really, really happy to see him.
The next morning,
this article was in the cover of the newspaper. It was Teens Teach Women Ugly Lesson, all about what happened. They wanted to find us. This was a tourist. You don't mess with tourists in a tourist-driven economy town, you know? And the mall was mad. It totally messed up the mall. They're like, you better find those girls. I mean, we were wanted, and they were going to find us.
She goes back to school, and 3 days later,
I was in the middle of fifth period in my history class, and the administrator came into the classroom and said that she needed me to come with her. Ugh. God, it was like 8,000 tons. bricks in my stomach at the same time. Just like, wow. So I walked with her and I remember the sound of her heels. Click, 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 click down the hall. It's like, oof. And so we get to the office and sure enough, there's two detectives standing there.
They said my name. You're going to have to come with us. Oh, you are going to have to come with us. I've had to walk through my high school.
People were staring. Like I was busted. They asked me where I was on Friday night. Where were you? Where'd you go? What time was that? And I was like, They took a headshot and then two side angles and then released me.
The next day is Valentine's Day.
Everything looked different. It was really cold and cloudy. And I got in my friend's car and he drove me to my dad's and I pulled up in the driveway and those same two detectives were standing there. And they told me to get in the car.
Get in the car.
And just sit where they could see me.
Sit where we can see you. And they arrested me right then and there.
They took me to jail. I was booked. It was over.
Linda and Mary pinned the whole thing on Alicia. They get reduced sentences, but she goes down hard.
I was charged with grand theft auto, kidnapping, assault, battery.
A lot of felonies.
I was sentenced to the girls' school until I turned 18.
Women's prison for juveniles. And the whole way to Albuquerque was just really sad because I drove that road to Albuquerque in that car, and it was a week later. Now I was driving to Albuquerque, going to jail, down the same freeway, passing the same landmarks. I remember seeing a homeless guy on the side of the street and being like, I envied him. I wished I was him. He doesn't realize that he's got fresh air right now. I just would rather be anywhere except for in the custody of the state of New Mexico. Like, nothing I could do about it. Clink, ching, ching, and you're in there. And then it's just so quiet.
Inside, Alicia is not the kind of girl who backs down.
People feared me. Somebody gives you a dirty look, like a geniosa, and you give them a geniosa back. And I fought, and I always won.
Alicia goes in hard, but she looks around and decides that deep down, she does not want to live this kind of life.
The woman that we carjacked wrote her an apology letter. And apologize. I mean, it seems like such a skinny word for the suffering that she went through.
She finally gets out, but no matter how many hours of community service she completes or restitution she pays...
The story followed me. I mean, everyone knew. Everybody knew. I just wanted to go back to life, but parents of friends of mine were like... Oh, you can't hang out with her. And it was strange to be stigmatized as a criminal.
In 1993, I come home from middle school one day, and my mom says, hey, surprise, we have company. Look who's in town for the weekend. And I turn and look, and there's Alicia, our long-lost family friend, fresh out of jail. She's going to stay with you in your room tonight. So when it's time to go to bed, I am freaked out, absolutely terrified, sure that she's going to beat me up or worse. I mean, we'd all heard the stories. But instead, we just talk all night long. Actually, I mostly listen while she tells me everything about that night and how sorry she is that she can never take back what happened to that woman.
After we carjacked this woman, I became hypersensitive to people's suffering. And it gets all over my face. I feel the pain of people. I feel it. And I don't think that would have happened had this not happened, you know? Getting busted made me better. And I think I ended up a better human being.
Judgment, what is your 1020? We have a domestic dispute between NPR and PRX. Snap judgment, come back.
Life sucked. Cubicle hell, all this and that. So I lived for the weekend. But the weekend sucked too. Friday and Saturday night, all my boys went out to the same bars with the same people with the same baseball caps. And the same ladies blew me off the same way they did the week before. It sucked. It sucked so bad. I needed to shake things up. So Friday night, everybody about to go out. I said, look at here. I'm not doing this anymore. My buddy Ray is like, what you going to do? Stay home? I'm going to dance. Everybody laughed. I'm like, look, there's a club in downtown Detroit. Let's go. Nobody says anything. I'm about to go solo. And Ray's like, all right, don't be a punk. We'll see your little place. But if it sucks, which it will, then we're back in the game tomorrow. Fine. We go. Downtown Detroit. The place is called Parabox. It's kind of a decrepit-looking storefront across the street from Tiger Stadium. But this is my thing. I made everybody come down here, so I gotta be cheery about it, right? We do hear this pulsing Latin music coming from the place. I think it's a good sign. $5 to get in, not bad. There's five of us. We walk in, and our mouths hit the floor. Beautiful women everywhere. Couples on the dance floor spinning, gorgeous colors, high heels, smiles, no jeans, dudes with dress slacks, bright white shirts, leading ladies through complicated step, spin, twirl, back, cool like I never seen cool before. Cool like Lando Calrissian cool.
Hello, what have we here?
Did I mention the ladies? Good Lord. None of us could move. We just stood there like dummies, blocking the flow of traffic. No way we could get on the dance floor. This was salsa. It was hot. It was all that was good in the world, and I knew nothing about it. We went home. The next morning at 7 a.m., my phone rang. It was Ray. Hey, man, get up. I signed us up for salsa class. It starts at an hour. It was on. Beautiful teacher, lovely. I knew I was going to like this class. She said it was easy. It was not. Salsa is eight steps. Eight steps. I couldn't get them. I tried. I couldn't get them. Otra vez. I kept messing up. We signed up for more classes just that day. Otra vez. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. She said I moved like a camel. But she said she needed 4 men for her new video. And she would choose them from our class the next week. I was going to be in that video. I practiced in the morning, at lunch, in the evening. 1, 2, 3. I practiced in the bathroom. 2, 3, 4, 5. I heard the beat. 1, 2, 3, 4. I heard it, but my feet wouldn't lift. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I just couldn't do it. I kept on trying. One time I came home from work and was dancing in the parking lot trying to get that beat on. I thought, no. I'm going to go back behind here in this little park area. Nobody's going to see me. I'm going to mind my own business, get my little dancing on. That's just what I did. I was back there trying. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And all of a sudden, cop car pulls up. What is it you're doing back here? Dancing. I'm going to need you to go ahead and sit down in your car for a while, sir. Yes, officer. I go sit in my car. Another cop car pulls up at the same time. I'm sitting down in my car, and another cop car pulls up. 3, 4, 5. I'm sitting there watching them come. 7, 8 police officer cars are parked around me. There is no way for me to go, so I wait. And I don't have a lot of time, you know. I got things to do. I'm a growing boy, so I'm trying to be patient. I have to be patient. But finally, I say, officers! Officers, is there a problem? Is it all right if I go on about my business? I was just out here dancing. Nothing. Officers, could someone please answer me, please? I just need to go on about my... Nothing. I wait some more. And then in practice, black male fashion, I roll down the window. I put both hands outside of the car. I've got nothing. Just want to talk to somebody. I've got nothing. I pull my hand down to unlock the car from the outside so that everybody knows nothing's going on. Click. Swarm. I am surrounded by dozens of police officers. They drag me out of the car, put
my head on the hood and put the cuffs on me, baby, nice and tight. Now, what did I do? Don't be asking me any questions. You going to jail. And they take me, they shove me, they go, watch your head, and they shove me in the back of the police car. And that is just what they do. They take me off to jail. What is going on? I'm starting to panic a little bit. They get me out of the car, into the police station, march me right by a great big old cell with lots of people. Thank goodness he keeps on walking and puts me in a cell by myself. Slam. And I'm like, what happened? I'm sitting there, and an officer comes up to the side of the cell. He says, hey, are you the one that's in here for dancing? I think so. Man, that is messed up. And he keeps on walking. I'm like, yeah, that's messed up. Get me up out of here. But he's gone. And again, I'm starting to get that panic on. I'm starting to panic. There's a phone right there. I call it to get a hold of my roommates, but this is back in the day. There's no broadband. They're on the internet. And no one is picking up the phone. I gotta stifle that panic. I gotta do something. I'm in this little bitty cell. I'm starting to get a little bit claustrophobic. I gotta do something. I gotta channel that energy. And just then I thought, well, you know what? You know what I'm gonna do? I'm gonna dance. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven. Wait, one, two, three. And we're just in, up in jail. And it occurs to me, when I'm trying to keep that panic down, it occurs to me, it's not eight steps. It's three. One, two, three, one, two, three, one, two, three. Quick, slow, quick, slow, quick. Quick, slow. One, two, three. Yeah, I'm starting to get it. Yeah. Get my little dance on. Then one of the officers is like, hey, sit down and be quiet over there. Ain't no dancing allowed in jail. I'm like, it's too late now, baby. What you gonna do? Put me in jail? One, two, three. Quick, slow. Finally, I get a hold of my roommate. I was like, bring all the white folk you can and come bail me up out of jail. And they come with a quickness. But I guess from where their vantage point was, they could see me in there dancing when they came, and they let me dance a little bit longer than I guess they technically had to. Ha ha. Very funny. When I get out, the next day, I go to class. And my teacher, she is amazed. Where did you learn how to dance? And I know she likes them hardcore brothers. So I let her know the truth. I learned to dance in jail. Snap judgment.
Here go that arrogant, stuffy head cold. Leave you aching from asses and shaking all night to rest. Well, medicine is that. Flip two of these. Call me in the morning. You gon' still feel sick cause it's that. Give them all a plague, I'm awfully paid and still make a cold star for days. Never the type that ran, whatever the fight I'm in. You half-hearted, but I take this medicine like a man for that. They keep these niggas sweating bullets, now them the ones that you call for trying to pull it, this, that. Somebody want an industry, that's on fire and burning in the third degree. Till they murder me, 5-0 get no words from me. And if they do, then that's perjury.
What's that? Don't be sad. Don't be sad. I'm not really busted. Handcuffs off, and I tell you what, it feels good. I'm a free man. You be a free person as well. Snap Judgment was produced by myself, but never alone. Never, ever, ever alone. Would you please join me in saying hello to the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich. That's right. The god of war and radio and hope and peace, our own Roman Mars. And do you speak and have people ignore you, talk over you, sometimes walk right through you? Well, that's a shame. That's a shame. You're probably a ghost. Too bad. It'd be better if you were Snap Judgment's own Rebecca Megahertz. Most Steph. Don't sleep on Stephanie Fu. She never sleeps. Don't you sleep either. Rita Daniels knows when you lie. Half man, half machine. Will Urbina. And you know, Snap Judgment storytelling with a beat needs a beat. We got a beat. Snap Judgment's own DJ, Smooth Grooves, shaking the ones and twos. Now, then maybe you're going to sleep, your teeth brushed, PJs on, the phone rings, and it's a collect call from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Please accept the charges. Tell them many thanks from their friends at Snap Judgment. Youth Speaks, identity, voice, power, imagination. YouthSpeaks.org. They inspire us and PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, putting the public back in media. Check them out, because we do. PRX.org. And even though this is not the news, not even close to the news, in fact, you could plan the crime of the century. Steal the Mona Lisa, sell it to a reclusive billionaire, double cross him, transfer all the Swiss bearer bonds into your Cayman Islands account. You could do all that and you would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is NPR. The producer of this very podcast, listening, judging, and condemning all she hears out of my mouth right now is Snap Judgment's own podcast producer, Rita Daniels.